Comic book, comic book, does whatever a book does. Read by us while drinking, incoherent rambling. Look out, this is our podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the SJW Comic Book Club, a weekly book club style podcast where three friends get together once a week to learn a little bit more about comics. Or at least that's what we usually do. This week is a mini-sode week, but because we didn't come up with any ideas for a new mini-sode, we decided to do something a little different. It's actually filler, but we don't really need to call it that. So I started a big read-through of X-Men stories starting in the early 2000s with Grant Morrison's run. And since we didn't have a mini-sode planned between the three of us, we figured I would record a brief mini-sode talking about some of the X-Men stories that I'm reading. So today's episode is going to feature three stories. All were released in May of 2001. They are New X-Men, issues 114 through 116, Extreme X-Men, issues 1 through 3, and Uncanny X-Men, issue 394. So starting with the first story, New X-Men, issues 114 through 116, the story arc is called E is for Extinction. This is by Grant Morrison with art by Frank Quietly. Melissa, Veronica, and I actually read and talked about this story as a main episode. I think it was in season 2 of the podcast. I really liked it then, and I think it definitely holds up now. With each of the stories, I'm going to summarize them, and then I'm going to talk about one overarching question that I had while I was reading it or after I finished, and then maybe talk a little bit about character development and all that stuff. So this story has a cold open of Cyclops and Wolverine destroying a Sentinel in order to save the mutant Ugly John. And Ugly John is exactly what he sounds like. He doesn't have any flashy powers or anything. His mutation has just caused him to be ugly. So Cyclops and Wolverine are bringing Ugly John back to the Xavier Mansion when Cerebro, the X-Men's mutant-detecting supercomputer, detects a power surge in Ecuador. Cyclops and Wolverine divert to Ecuador and decide to bring Ugly John along, thinking that this is just a routine new mutant emergent. But waiting for them in Ecuador is actually the big bad of the story, Cassandra Nova. So Cassandra is Professor Xavier's evil twin, who Xavier killed, in quotes, while they were in the womb. She survived, and she's back for revenge. So she's used her powers to commandeer some Sentinels, which she uses to capture Cyclops and Wolverine, kill Ugly John, and destroy the mutant sanctuary of Genosha. So Genosha is the mutant nation ruled by Magneto. So when this is destroyed, like, millions of mutants die, and basically the entire status quo for the X-Men changes. This also happens really quickly, and there's not a whole lot of exposition in this story. It really, like, it opens with a bang, and it ends with a bang. Cassandra destroys Genosha, and she makes her way to the Xavier Mansion, where she plans to take over Professor Xavier's body using her own telepathic abilities. However, she is stopped when Emma Frost, who has survived the destruction of Genosha, snaps her neck, seemingly killing her. So that's pretty much it. Like, that's pretty much what happens in the story. It's very straightforward, but it's very fast-paced, and it's kind of subversive because you don't really expect for Genosha to get destroyed. We learn basically from the beginning of the story, from issue 1, that Cassandra is going to try to destroy Genosha using the Sentinels, but we don't expect her to succeed, so when she does, it's kind of surprising. So that kind of leads into my overall feeling about this issue. Which is that I really enjoy it, but the X-Men really don't do a good job here. Like, they fail at literally everything. So what is good about a story where the heroes fail? And I think that the thing that makes this story good, especially since it's the beginning of Grant Morrison's run and it's setting up for the things that they're going to talk about later on in New X-Men, having the heroes fail at the beginning gives so many directions for them to go. So there's the ramifications of their failure on the social level, like, what does the world look like now that Genosha is gone and Magneto is supposedly dead? There's also on the personal level. At this point in the story, Scott is starting to take over more responsibility on the X-Men, and he's coming into a leadership role even more so than he was before. And by the end of New X-Men, Scott is basically going to be the full leader of the team. And that all starts with Scott losing someone in the field. Like, he goes with Wolverine to rescue Ugly John, but Ugly John ends up being murdered in front of him. And then a few minutes after that, all of Genosha is destroyed. So all of this happens on his watch and during his mission. There's a lot of different directions you can go with that, especially with Scott Summers, who's like a character who's full of self-loathing and has these extremely high expectations for himself and feels this constant responsibility to not only his fellow X-Men, but to the mutant race in general. So I think while it's not really explored in this story because everything happened so quickly and the conclusion comes rather abruptly, it leaves a lot of space in further stories to explore, like, what happens after the heroes fail? How do they sort of recover from that? And I think the rest of New X-Men does do a pretty good job of wrestling with that question, especially on the personal level. So, yeah, it's a really good story vehicle because it gives a lot of different directions for the story to go in. And I think Grant Morrison explores a lot of those directions on the personal level really well. So, to talk a little bit more about character development here, like I mentioned Emma Frost, one of the things that comes up that Grant Morrison introduces in E is for Extinction is the idea of secondary mutations, which becomes a really important part of like the X-Men universe, I guess you could call it. So Emma Frost originally is just a telepath, but when Genosha is destroyed, the way that she survives is her secondary mutation activates, which causes her to turn into a diamond. Emma also joins the X-Men in this issue, or in these issues, which is really important character development for her because the X-Men have a history of accepting sort of reformed villains and rehabilitated baddies from previous stories. So that's not necessarily new. However, it is new for Emma. So during the 90s, Emma Frost had a lot of character development where she sort of became a reformed villain. She started teaching, she formed relationships with students and with other mutants. In the Generation X book, she really becomes sort of a, I guess you could call her an anti-hero. So she's been X-Men adjacent for quite a while at this point, but this is the first time I think that she actually joins the X-Men. And Emma joining the X-Men is great for her character because it allows her to, walk more into the spotlight and be explored more by a lot of different writers, which is always good. But then also the dynamic between Emma and some of the other X-Men is great. Like, there's her relationship with Scott, which Morrison is going to develop and turn into a thing, which is great. I really love Emma's relationship with Scott. But outside of that, there's also her relationship with, like, Beast, who becomes her friend. They have a very intellectual relationship where they like to get together and enjoy, like, different plays and stuff. Or some of the relationships that are a little more antagonistic, like her relationship with Jean Grey, which there's obvious problems there. When Emma Frost and Jean Grey first met, Jean basically destroyed her mind and put her into a coma. So there's a lot of resentment and animosity there, and that causes Emma to kind of go after Scott romantically just to fuck with Jean, and then eventually she ends up falling in love with him. So the last character development in this story that I have to talk about is the character development of Scott. We already talked about, or I already talked about, Scott having someone die on his mission and then failing to protect Genosha and all that. But the reason that that's so impactful is because in New X-Men, Scott starts the process of taking over the X-Men, and he's giving them something of a new mission statement. It's not completely divergent from what Xavier believed, but it is different. During the course of the conflict in Ecuador, and while Scott and Wolverine are trying to save Ugly John, Scott says something along the lines of, "We don't leave anyone behind." Like, basically, the X-Men are here to protect all mutants. And that's actually a little bit different from the mission that Xavier had in mind for the X-Men. While the X-Men under Xavier do protect mutants, their primary goal really is to demonstrate to humans that mutants are not a threat. And while Scott does believe in that and will do some of that, he's saying here, and the way that he conducts the team in the future really shows that Scott sees the X-Men as a group that needs to be concerned with protecting mutants primarily and mutant kind. And having him starting to take the reins and control of the team and control of the mission of the team at the time when Genosha is destroyed really makes that philo it really demonstrates why that philosophy is needed, like why mutants need protection. Genosha is the sanctuary for mutants. It's a place where millions of mutants are gathered together under the protection of Magneto, who's one of the most powerful mutants in the world. So if any place should be safe for mutants, it should be Genosha, but it's attacked and destroyed very quickly and with very little fanfare, and no one is really able or positioned to protect it. That really shows why Scott's philosophy is so needed, like why there needs to be a team of mutants that are willing to do whatever it takes to protect mutant kind. And this really defines Scott's character development for the next, like, what, 20 years? He'll gradually escalate further and further until he gets to the point where he really is willing to do absolutely whatever it takes to protect the interests of mutant kind and protect the survival of mutant kind. And you have so many things that go wrong during that time. This makes Scott Summers, I think, one of the most interesting characters, not only in the X-Men, but in comics in general. And it really all does start here. Like, it's a foundation that's laid by Grant Morrison in this story. So I think it's really important that this is the beginning of Scott starting to take over the X-Men. This is what happens at the beginning of that period. So last thing to talk about for this story is just the art. Frank Quitely's Potato People are great. There's so many fun panels, like there's the cold open. When Cassandra Nova first confronts Xavier and she's like, I'm going to take over your mind. Xavier's like, no, you're not. And he takes out a gun and he's like going to shoot himself. And it's not funny because it's very fraught and it's very dramatic, but it's also extremely funny. Just the idea of Xavier carrying a gun. I don't know why. And the way that it's drawn, it's just like, it's funny. Whatever. Also, Cassandra Nova really, just like in every panel, I can't say specifically what it is, but the way that Frank Quitely draws her is so fun. Like it makes her a really fun villain, a really sort of campy villain, even though she probably has the highest body count of any of the X-Men villains, but the way that she's drawn is just a little bit, it's just silly enough that it's not too serious or overwhelming or whatever. So I really like the art. I think Frank Quitely does a great job. Unfortunately, he sets the bar really, really high for new X-Men, and in future stories it doesn't really achieve that bar. Like Frank Quitely and a few of the other artists who worked on new X-Men do a really, really great job, but then that makes it all the more jarring when there's a fill-in artist who, doesn't do as great of a job. But here it's awesome. So the second story I'm going to talk about in this episode is Extreme X-Men issues 1 to 3. The story arc is called Now It Begins. This was written by Chris Claremont with art by Salvador LaRocca. It's also from May 2001. So in this story, a squad of X-Men under Storm is headed to Spain. The squad consists of Storm, Bishop, Rogue, Gambit, Psylocke, Beast, Sage, who is a mutant supercomputer, and Thunderbird, who is probably not a very well-known character, but that's for good reason because he kind of sucks. So this squad has formed to locate the Destiny Diaries, a group of books written by the mutant Destiny, who has the ability to see the future. Destiny wrote her visions into her diaries and then hid them for some reason that I don't quite understand. For another reason that I don't quite understand, Storm has decided to lead a breakaway group of X-Men because she doesn't trust Xavier anymore for some reason. In issue 3, I believe, she says something about not trusting him because he's a telepath and he has too much power or something. I don't know. I don't really know what that means. He's always been a telepath and Storm has always been a part of his team and trusted him. So I don't really know what's changed. Maybe it's something that happened in the like late 90s that I just don't know about. But in this story, the X-Men are attacked by Action Force, which is a wing of the Spanish military, because it is illegal to be a mutant in Spain. The X-Men are captured by Action Force and they're put into a maze for some reason to test their abilities. They make it through the maze, but are then attacked by the new villain, Vargas, who is some kind of super soldier not affiliated with the Spanish government. I don't really know what Vargas's deal is or why he's there, but he is really good at kicking the X-Men's ass. And After kicking their ass, he kills Psylocke and he maims Beast, leaving him for dead. And that's really all that happens. It's a pretty straightforward story, but despite being straightforward, it just feels extremely long and difficult to read through. And there are so many words explaining this really, really simple story, but also not explaining anything because, like I said, I don't know where Vargas comes from. I don't know why Storm doesn't trust Xavier. I don't know why in Spain it's randomly illegal to be a mutant. I don't know. I don't get it. I didn't really have any specific questions or feelings about this story, so I'll just say overall what stuck out the most to me, and it really is the art. So Salvador Larroca is an artist that I have a bias against. And I don't know why, I just don't like his style very much. I'm sure a lot of, I know a lot of people do. They must, because he's like a really famous comic book artist, but it just never works for me. I find it to be really stagnant. And for this story in particular, it's such a poor fit because this is the first issue of Extreme X-Men. It's the beginning of Claremont's return to the X-Men after however many years it's been. And the second issue of this story is almost entirely action, but it's so boringly drawn that it just feels like it's just as much of a slog as all the exposition. And like the way that things are drawn, it looks like a bunch of snapshots. There's not a whole lot of movement. The action scenes are boring. The exposition is boring. There's like three facial expressions that are being made. I just really don't like the art. There will be more impactful and terrible things in future Extreme X-Men issues, but this is the thing that sticks out to me the most about this story arc is just how much the art does a disservice to the story. But there is character development that happens here. Like I said, Psylocke, the X-Men's super ninja, dies. It just kind of happens. Like she's just dead. So there's not a lot to say about it. She's just dead. Psylocke is a character that I really like, but I can't think of very many iconic Psylocke storylines that happened before 2010. I can't think of very many of them. And yet, Psylocke is a character who's always there. So, like, Psylocke is an important member of the X-Men. She's part of the, I would say, like, the core 90s team. But I can't really think of any iconic Psylocke storyline, so I don't know why Claremont would bring in this character just to like kill her off rather than actually exploring her character in any meaningful way. But that's neither here nor there. Storm, we get to see Storm leading a team, which is nice. I think that Claremont is probably one of the best people at writing Storm, and I think her characterization like totally works for me. Again, I don't really understand why she all of a sudden doesn't trust Charles Xavier. That seems like it should have been explained a little bit more, and it never really is. We don't ever really understand why Storm and Xavier have this rift, but getting to see Storm leading a squad is always nice. There are a lot of characters introduced in Extreme X-Men, and in this issue we get Vargas, we get Thunderbird, we kind of get Sage. I don't know if this is necessarily her first appearance, but this is what I always think of as her first appearance. But overall, most of the characters that are introduced here are not used after the book ends, and most of the character development from Extreme X-Men largely gets ignored by other writers. So you can't really say that this really introduces a lot of new story elements or anything. It's not really very exciting. There's not really anything that happens here that's all that exciting. So I'm just going to move on. And the last story that I've got for you is Uncanny X-Men issue 394, Playing God. This is by Joe Casey with art by Ian Churchill. This is the first issue of Joe Casey's run on Uncanny, and it introduces the single appearance villain Warp Savant. So Savant attacks Cape Citadel, the military base where the X-Men had their first adventure fighting Magneto in X-Men number one. Wolverine and Jean Grey show up, but they immediately fall victim to Savant's powers. He is able to draw matter into his mind, transporting them to an alternate reality where they are immediately attacked. Cyclops and Angel arrive at Cape Citadel and begin attacking Savant, which causes his mindscape to lose some integrity or something, and Wolverine and Jean are sure they are going to die. Wolverine kisses Jean. It's gross. However, as Cyclops and Angel defeat Savant, all the people who have been sucked into his mind are released, and he kills himself. And that's it. That's all that happens. The overall feeling that I had from this story was the question of, is Wolverine and Jean Grey's relationship actually interesting? That's like the main focus of this issue, is Wolverine and Jean Grey's relationship. And honestly, no, it's not interesting. I think that Wolverine's obsession with Jean Grey is weird, and I think that Jean Grey's attraction to Wolverine is absurd. So, no, that's all. I don't have any more to say about it. It's just not. So the character development that happens in this story is that Angel rejoins the X-Men. However, Joe Casey's concept of Angel is not one that I enjoy. So Angel in this story is, he's blue, which is cool. Angel being blue is cool. But he has like a super blonde crew cut and like really heavily blonde eyebrows. So he just looks like, it's hard to explain what he looks like. He just looks so aggressive and like, I don't know, I hate it. And he acts the same way. Like, Angel is an absolute jerk when Joe Casey writes him. He's like this weird sort of alpha male, but also a little piss baby, and it's weird. He's like simultaneously extremely aggressive and extremely whiny. And I don't want to read any more about him, but I'm going to because Angel rejoins the X-Men in this issue. Half of the characters in this issue aren't actually going to be part of the team Casey is writing, including Jean Grey. So even though you get the Wolverine and Jean Grey kiss, it isn't very consequential because Casey isn't going to be writing about Jean. So it doesn't get expanded on during the rest of Casey's run. And I think that's fine because, like I said, I think Wolverine and Jean Grey's relationship doesn't make any sense and it's not interesting. So that's really all I have to say about these three stories. But since this is a comic book podcast, I have to rate them. If you're not ranking the stories that you're talking about, there's no point in having a podcast about comic books. So I'm going to do that now. I think New X-Men issues 114 through 116 is definitely the best for all the reasons that I talked about. I think of the three stories, it's the only one that really sets up a story that you really want to continue reading. Even though I have more negative reactions to Extreme X-Men issues 1 through 3, at least the story is setting up future story arcs. So I think it deserves number two. Like, there's things that are happening there that are interesting. A main character gets killed off. You do want to know the answers to the questions of, like, who is Vargas and why is Storm distrustful of Xavier? You're never going to find out because they're not questions that Chris Claremont wants to answer, but you do at least want to know the answer. So I think that's good for an introductory story arc. And then Uncanny X-Men 394 is really a bit of a throwaway issue. So the only point of the story is Angel joining the X-Men. That's the only thing that has any, you know, consequences outside of this story. And then most of the story is about the kiss between Wolverine and Jean Grey, which is dumb and also doesn't really go anywhere. Also, I hate Angel's new look and I hate his attitude even worse. So Uncanny X-Men 394 comes in at number 3 for now. I hope you enjoyed this X-Men minisode for whatever it was, and I'll probably be doing them whenever we come up on a minisode week that we don't have anything recorded for or anything set up. I like talking about the X-Men, and I like ranking things, so I'll continue to do that. If I forgot to say it before, there are links to the story arcs that I read in the episode description, and I will be back next week along with Melissa and Veronica to talk about Amazing Spider-Man issues 1 through 6, Parker Luck, along with our special guest from Not a Hoax, Not a Dream podcast. It was a fun episode to record, and hopefully you all will enjoy it as well. If you want to reach out to us, you can find us on Instagram or Twitter at SJW Comics Cast, or you can email us at sjwcomicspodcast@gmail.com. And I'm tired of talking now, and I'm sure you're tired of listening to me, so I'm going to stop. Bye.